podcast talking all things health technology and NHS IT. Welcome to Digital Health Unplugged. Hello and welcome to Digital Health Unplugged. I'm your host, Jordan Soloff, news reporter at Digital Health. And this episode is the first in a new podcast series that we're hosting for our networks members. Today's edition, we'll have a bit of an AI focus. We'll be looking at the role of effective teams in deploying digital platforms in the NHS. Our panelists will explore the pivotal role of cohesive teams in successfully implementing digital platforms, with a particular focus on AI applications in the NHS. So we delve into the synergies between teamwork and the deployment of cutting-edge tech, and highlighting the crucial interplay between collaboration, skill diversity, and efficient communication in maximising the benefits of AI for healthcare innovation and patient outcomes. So, should be an interesting episode ahead of us. And to drive it, I have three great guests alongside me from each network panel. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So, could you tell our listeners who you are and what you do? And I'll start with Leah, who I can see on my left.
Thanks, Jordan. Hi there, I'm Leah Ali. I'm on the CCIO advisory panel for the Digital Health Networks, and I'm a consultant psychiatrist. So I'm a doctor who's been working in digital health for quite a long time. I work in the South London and Maudsley NHS Trust, and I also work in NHS England in the Transformation Directorate.
Great. Nice to have you here, Leah. Nick?
Hi, I am Nick Black. I'm on the CIO network. Advisory panel. I am the CIO at Gateshead Health, which is an acute and community trust, and I chair the Northeast North Cumbria CIO network. And I've had the pleasure of being involved in digital health for 32 years.
Wow, brilliant. And last but not least, Simon.
Yeah, so I'm Simon Knoll. I'm the chair of the CNIO advisory panel. I'm the CNIO at Oxford University Hospitals, and I have been working with digital technology in one form or another about the last 22 years in various different roles.
Brilliant. Thanks all for coming on the podcast. Right, we're going to get straight into it. And starting with user-centered design, obviously that's essential when you're kind of developing digital solutions tailored to the needs of healthcare professionals. Could you each share kind of how you believe that approach ensures the usability and effectiveness of AI applications in the NHS?
So the importance of design within digital health systems and services, I think, cannot be underestimated. So it's definitely something I've been on a journey with in my career. So I've worked frontline in the NHS, designing and delivering digital and non-digital clinical systems, and have also worked in industry and also done some specific work around user-centered design. And very much that journey was informed by seeing that problems kind of weren't being framed correctly and seeing that needs weren't being met. And when I started on that journey, I didn't know that what I was looking for was sort of design-led methodologies, but have very much come to understand that these are vital to delivery of safe and effective systems. You can't really be delivering safe and high quality care unless you are really using all the tools that you have available to be able to understand what those user needs really are. And thinking about that in a strategic way is very important, more than just thinking about interface design, etc., which is where UX and UCD has tended to be. That's the sort of narrative I tend to hear, rather than that real sort of strategic delivery implementation interface, which is actually where it operates across all of those.
Absolutely, yeah. Anything to add there on user-centered design, Simon or Nick?
In August last year, I handed in my MSc Digital Health Leadership dissertation in, and I did a chunk of work on there looking at usability. And there's loads of research around the acceptability of digital systems needs to be much more focused on not just usability, but on the acceptability to the clinician, looking at functionality and likability and cost, which you can measure, but actually is what makes it acceptable to clinicians to use. So it's trying to find ways of looking at how to make things better for clinicians to use and designing it around how they want to work.
Yeah, Simon?
Yeah, I think you mean both earlier and Nick make fantastic points. And I think it all comes down to if the design is right and if the process is inclusive, then users feel engaged. And if users feel engaged, they're more likely to accept the technology and adopt it. If they accept and adopt it, it means usage is, the quality of usage is much better. And if you get better usage, you get better data collection, which means that you're ultimately, the way that you can interpret that data and the way you use that data, including AI, can be improved. So it's almost like a tiered ground up approach to making sure that what you ultimately need to get out of your digital systems is nurtured at the very inception, if you like, and user-led design is fundamental to that.
I can give an example, Jordan, if that's helpful. Mm-hmm. So right back at the beginning of my career in digital, I was working on patient health records in the Maudsley. And it was a really fascinating program that came from a patient empowerment perspective. So the idea was to, what can you do? What are the digital enablers that you could use to really get people properly activated in their care? And that being a technical term, that we know when people are activated in their care, they have better health outcomes. They have reduced long-term condition endpoints, for example, in diabetes, around cardiovascular disease, et cetera. And this was in a group of people. So we know that people with severe mental illness are likely to use maybe somewhere between 13 and 20 years of their life lost compared to the average person in the population. So you're talking really big outcomes and really big things to tackle. And the work that we were doing there involved doing things like getting people to record their mood outcomes with clinically validated outcome measures, you know, scales of anxiety, depression or psychosis, and also physical health measures. So things like Wi-Fi enabled blood pressure monitoring. And on top of that, there was this thing about having people's care plans and those being available to people within this PHR. And one of the things that kind of really, really sort of set me on the path of wanting to learn more about user-centered design and actually how I got involved in the program was this recognition that they had real problems recruiting people into the program and it had to go via care coordinators. And when I got involved and I was working in one of the teams that looked after people with psychosis, it was very clear that getting the care coordinators, the staff, to actually sign people up for this patient held record program, you had to be addressing the staff's need as well as the patient need. And actually what we did was we aligned a trust requirement around giving people access to their care plans to signing them up to the patient health record, and immediately drove adoption by, you know, hundreds of percent basically. And at the same time, what that enabled us to do was to really, once you've got that adoption in place, you can start doing that really important work around actually changing that relationship that people have with their healthcare provider and their healthcare service. So, for example, we had an example of one person who had been detained under section 3-4 times in their life. So had their liberties taken away from them, really serious mental illness, huge distrust of services. In this program, once he'd been signed up, he could then take control of what he was doing, started to do the mood monitoring, could see that his mood was deteriorating, could see that his blood pressure was high himself, took himself to his GP for his lithium levels to be checked and for blood pressure medication to be started and for that to be managed. So, you know, tackling really big things, but you really have to think really carefully about the whole landscape of what people, of what users' needs are, and design for those.
Great, thanks, Leah. Really nice example there. And when you think about putting the user at the centre, that kind of flows nicely into collaboration. And I want to ask kind of how do interdisciplinary teams within the NHS kind of contribute to the successful integration of digital platforms, particularly thinking about AI applications?
Well, I think for me, there's something around structure and the implementation side. So from a project management approach, so you have the project lead, you have the but it's designing that implementation team right. But the most fundamental bit of all of this is for me is around the sharing of work and experience between a clinical business change business analyst type role, so somebody who really can do the translation between technology and how clinicians work, alongside the more technical system admin, the people who run and build and configure the system to make it effective for clinicians to use. And it's that those two kind of crossover pieces which really drive successful deployment, really.
Simon?
Yeah, like Nick, I also submitted my MSc dissertation last year, but not for the, mine was in healthcare informatics, but I looked at the fostering critical thinking in nursing, but it could be applied to any clinical group. Now, the engagement with the multidisciplinary services is actually really critical at this point. So if we go back to user-centered design, if you express the profession through the design and the workflows where that design is to be used, then again, it fosters engagement and it fosters understanding of colleagues and different interdisciplinary groups. So that then gets a better voice, and also it fosters and supports professional identity within the digital space. And it means that each group can then understand, get better understanding of how they may use that data and use that technology to manage their patients more effectively. So it's fundamental that there is a professional voice as well as a professional interest in how the systems are designed and built, so that that expression can be valid throughout the deployment, delivery and adoption. And I think that's really important to make sure that there is inclusivity across different domains.
There is that balance with record keeping, clinical record keeping, and those record standards are really important, and it's very easy for them to drift when you put technology, unless you do that and use a design.
Definitely.
I mean, for me, it comes very much back to this thing about this tension between technology-led versus design-led. And absolutely, as both Nick and Simon have said, having a multidisciplinary team is 100% vital to that. And it's also about having the right voices collaborating in the right way. It has to be on an equal, respectful basis. I've all too often seen something that's maybe driven very clinically or something that's very driven very technically, and neither of those work, because you need all the voices with equal weight in order to be able to understand what the factors are that are going to affect successful deployment and development. And when you come to something like AI deployment, so I was chatting with one of my colleagues, Harris Shuaib, who's the head of clinical scientific computing at Guy's and St. Thomas's, and he was talking about how that multidisciplinary work is just so vital, because until you have clinicians and scientists in the room when you are doing stuff like looking at, you know, how to look at nodules that you find on x-rays of, you know, of blood clots, etc., and differentiating that from tumors, you start to get down to real nuances that don't speak to where you might be able to say something about the accuracy of what that algorithm can do. There's another layer there, which is around that clinical nuance, which is absolutely vital to understanding the consequences of a miss. You can't have that conversation in any kind of silo. That has to be done in a multidisciplinary way. And I think one of the problems that we have with the way that we do things is we don't often put the resource and we don't put in the time and space for that to happen adequately, particularly with emerging technologies, especially around things that we're looking around generative AI, etc., where the number of unknown unknowns becomes even greater than other types of digital deployment, and becomes even more important to put those gates in, because you are not dealing with something which is very sort of scientific hypothesis, linear, cause and effect driven. It's much more complex than that. I mean, we use a number of different models. The Kinefin model is one that I quite like for sort of explaining this, which is the idea that a lot of us think we're in this complicated linear relationship space, and actually we're not. We're actually more in a complex or even sometimes a chaotic space where the impact of where we might make a change can have wide-ranging consequences, which are actually very difficult to predict, which means you have to do your experimentation in a different way. It means you have to put in constraints to be able to analyse what those impacts are.
Great, thanks. Really interesting points there. Nick?
I've got a good example. So we have, a couple of years ago, we implemented the Kieran AI platform into breast screening in Gateshead. So we put that in. Initially, year one was essentially to upload data just to get comfortable with the tools and to get the system to learn the technologies. And then we moved into the sort of auditing mode. So actually just running it to validate and check the sort of clinical decision making, which it makes in the background. And then as more confidence and that development of confidence in the team goes, and, you know, confidence for me is from a technology point of view is around speed and reliability and things like that, as well as the clinical support. As that grew, then it allows you to kind of start using it to actually start reading images and I guess recommending, suggesting the actions to take on the back of them. But we're not quite in that phase yet, but that's the kind of direction of travel which enables you to go.
And you know, when we're thinking about implementing digital platforms here in healthcare organisations, it comes with its challenges. And kind of one of the key ones, I think, is resistance to change. Almost for some, maybe it can almost be a little bit scary or overwhelming, maybe the thought of change, moving into the unknown a little bit. So I'm interested to kind of find out from each of you some what your reasons for kind of why that resistance happens within the NHS context, and kind of how effective teams can overcome those barriers.
It's not an easy subject to boil down into a small soundbite. But I think there's a couple of facets which we need to remember is that the NHS in its digital journey is very has been scarred in the past by the way deployments have happened and the way that we put these things out. And I think a lot of it's been alluded to by what we've already discussed with regards to the lack of user-centered design, the lack of clinician engagement, and the lack of operational professional engagement, which means that people don't see any ownership in the technology that's being deployed on them rather than with them, and that itself breeds resistance, because if they don't feel included in the process, they won't feel as though they're a part of the process. There's also small things like digital enablement and the ability of some members of staff to actually use technology in a meaningful way. We had a really good deployment, and beginning of last year we completed, but it was for theatre documentation and scheduling, and we had been using a legacy theatre management system for a number of years, but it was very basic, and we replaced it with a comprehensive patient record scheduling and record system. Now, the challenges there were that the system was not easily able to express the different specialities through the scheduling process. So that was the first challenge. And secondly, there are a lot of people in theatres in this particular process who had never used technology in this way before. So when it came to it, they felt threatened, and they felt as though that they had nowhere to go. And they thought that they're, and they felt as though that they may be undermined in the process. So it took a great deal of reassurance, education, training and nurturing to be able to bring those people on board. But in the end, we managed it. We've got lots of cases of people who were really threatened by the process, but with the appropriate support and education, they actually engage with it and actually become champions for the process. So it can be done really effectively, but it's all to do with setting the environment, setting the expectations, including the individuals in the process, but also enabling them in that process so they don't feel as though they're being threatened by it. And all these factors are really, really important to make sure that you take your clinicians along with you.
Yeah, so we often talk about that involvement as being really quite important quite early in the process. Quite often, development has, especially around clinical engagement, has kind of centered on the very technical clinical safety assurances that come right at the end of a process. And actually, there's a whole load of stuff that we would think about in designing non-digital services, just traditional clinical services, clinical governance, legal requirements, CQC responsibility, all of these things, professional responsibilities that come into when you think about designing any clinical service. It doesn't have to be digital. And very much for me, there we are exactly as Simon said, we're on a path of kind of evolution around that, or the thinking around that, not thinking about the digital piece, the technology piece as a nice to have or an add-on. This is fundamental to the way we're delivering our services. And you wouldn't think about building a whole new hospital or a whole system of clinics and hospitals and GP practices in a particular area and involving one clinician at the end of the process to think about how that might or might not operate. And this is often what I've seen, both in industry and in the NHS, as being really impacting on actually delivery times, outcomes, safety incidents, is the lack of that recognition of actually what we're doing is these are clinical services. So you have to treat them in the same way you would any clinical service and have all of those considerations up front and early. And again, that's what feeds, I think, a lot of people's resistance, because they might know one little piece of that. It might come out in a particular way. I'm reminded very much of the Royal Mail scandal. Actually, this impacts people. This kind of digitization impacts people in their jobs every single day, every minute of the day. And assumptions will be made about what the systems can and can't do. And where, especially with with AI development, where there is lack of understanding about what that really can and can't do, or what you might have influence on as a frontline operator, whether you're a clinician, an administrator, whoever you are within the system, that also breeds a lot of uncertainty and discomfort, and rightly so, because you don't know where your ability to govern what you're doing stops and ends and what you have control over. So for me, it's always quite obvious that people are going to feel that worry. And absolutely, as Simon said, you have to address those fears early in order to be able to deal with them.
And for me, it's much broader than just that. It's much broader than just involvement. It's actual engagement right at the front.
Yep.
When you're setting up and establishing a business case and a project for this, quite often you get the usual suspects who put themselves forward, which kind of skews how delivery of systems goes. But actually, it needs to be a much broader collection of people involved, because inherently clinicians are intelligent, and it needs to be designed in a way that they won't find workarounds to find an easier way to do things. It needs to be, the right thing has to be an easy thing for them to do. So it needs to fit with the clinical practice and that clinical work. And the more people you get involved in that is crucial.
I think one of the things that we look back at the Hive deployment up in Manchester last year. I mean, listen to the guys there. I think it was actually Rewired last year, was it? I can't remember now. Anyway, it was, but they were talking about the way they approached it, and it was always meant to be a surface level change facilitated by digital, and that's the way they tiered it. So you had really overall good engagement from the chief nurse and for the chief medical officer about what the expectation was, but also what the expectation was of the project to deliver at that time as well. And if I go back to the example of our theatre deployment here, one of the biggest successes in that was actually making sure that there was a clinician at the centre of the deployment, somebody who could be that focus of clinical concern, but also who could be the conduit of interpretation for both teams. That happened to be one of my deputies from my team who was actually did that. And it made such a difference in engaging users and maintaining the pace of change as well. And that was fundamental to the success of the project.
I personally think we have to go further than that, because I think there's often you can see this in the funding of CCIO roles and the sorts of, amount of resource that's available. You can't assume that having one clinician is going to be enough to make this fit for purpose. It has to be done properly, with properly looking at What are your user groups? What are their needs? How does this actually impact all of those things about how they feel about their responsibility, what they actually have to take account of? And I definitely see too much of that at the moment, yeah. That there might be no one, and then there might be one person, and actually that's still not enough.
Yeah, but just to clarify that point, but you're absolutely right. I mean, whilst she was a core to it, there was still a raft of clinical engagement across the services, which she then could then be almost the referee for, if you like, and that was where the engagement came from. But you're absolutely right, Leah.
I think that for me, there's something I always kind of say that there needs to be a clinician who owns and loves the system. So actually, somebody who actually is emotionally attached to it being good, it being the best it can be, and driving that. So a great example is the sort of chief maternity information officer roles. So within maternity, you've got lead clinicians who are actively driving the implementation of maternity systems. They probably have more time and a smaller footprint to cover. But actually the difference they've made into the richness of the records is astonishing.
Great, yeah, thanks. Some good points there. Coming back to the idea around kind of teamwork, collaboration, communication, they're obviously all important components for maximising the benefits of AI for healthcare innovation in the NHS. Could you each kind of share some insights into the specific challenges and benefits of fostering collaboration among diverse teams and kind of how that efficient communication contributes to the successful deployment of cutting-edge tech?
I saw a great 2x2 matrix, which kind of touches on this, which was how much that somebody cares about you, and that your boss cares about you, or the team cares about you, and how much professional respect you have for your boss or your team, which you're working into. So both those two things together, if you're cared for by the and care for the project, and actually you're professionally respected within there, then actually that drives engagement and team delivery. So it takes people with you. Unless you've got somebody who cares and somebody who's professionally capable of delivering it, actually, you know, you don't necessarily get all of that engagement and drive to be successful.
For me, there's something about the way we do our processes, like literally down to the way we manage our programs, etc. And where I've seen it work really well is where that collaborative, non-hierarchical approach is really bought into. You know, right down to using things like, as you've been involved in, you know, silent voting on collaborative whiteboards and that sort of thing, and, you know, would have been post-it notes before. That it can sometimes see, I think, for sometimes from people from the outside, it can seem silly, but actually there's a point to making some of those things anonymous, because otherwise you get certain voices dominating, you get certain ideas, you can't get to the right solutions, you tend to solutionize too early without allowing that place for, it's actually a place for creativity, actually. And you have to always remember that the people in those rooms, you might have, it makes me think of human factors, actually. It makes me think of training in human factors and thinking about how that operates. And that, you know, there's the very famous story of Martin Bromley's wife, actually, where, you know, there were kind of multiple human factors going on, but there was a more junior person in the corner who brought the tray out with the equipment that was actually needed. But there was something about that person's position that didn't allow them to be able, there were structures weren't in place to allow that person to speak up, to make that what would have been a life-saving intervention, actually. And I think this plays out over and over again in the way we do our work. We see we don't have that right level of respect, but also processes and tools being used so that we can make sure we are taking into account all those factors and they are being surfaced, and that we are allowing the right things to emerge rather than having a predetermined idea of how things work. And that absolutely comes into enabling people to communicate. The best pieces of work I've seen are the ones where a lot of attention has been paid to who are this group? Have we got the right people? What are the barriers to them being able to speak up or being able to input, right down to, do they have the time to do that? You know, do they have, is there something additional about, are they neurodiverse? Is there something specific around who they are within the system, addressing things like diversity of the workforce and designing in an inclusive way? These are all really, really important things in terms of addressing those communication issues.
I think building on what's been already been said, quite often clinicians are very blinkered in the way that they work, and they see the world in the terms of the speciality in which they choose to work. And what this tends to do, it tends to make those people, although we're looking for subject matter experts and asking people to contribute towards system design and user-led design and the like, you have to be wary that these designs and these changes aren't made in silos. So, I mean, we have a very good example here is when we first designed our nursing care plans and deployed our nursing care plans, we went to the subject matter experts. We said, well, how do you want your care plans to look? What do you want included in them? And how would you want them to be expressed, this sort of thing? What we ended up with, a load of care plans with a lot of duplication, with a lot of care plans who were that would say the same things. And when we came to deploy them, very naive at the time, it's one of my first jobs in this particular role, it was we're seeing this particular task appearing 3 or 4 times. Actually, we only need it once. So it's understanding that each change cannot be treated in a silo. It must be treated as part of the operational and patient care workflow, so that the expression of the clinical speciality and the way they need to collect data is accurate, but that it doesn't overbear the person delivering care. It doesn't mean that the person delivering care is overwhelmed by the volume of information that's being required of them. And you get situations where you have clinical assessments where they think, well, we need to collect all this information. Well, and then you go and do an assessment a couple of years down the line and find out that 80% of the data items within a particular assessment may have never been used or used less than 1% of the time. And those are the situations it's good to avoid, because then it doesn't drag the clinical service down, the clinicians down, to make sure that it's a wider conversation about how we care for patients in the longitudinal way, not just at the point of particular intervention.
It kind of links back to what was said before about team, about having the right interdisciplinary team. So actually having, we've had exactly the same issues with it. You know, you end up scoping a care plan which is pages and pages long, an assessment which is pages and pages long, and then a year later you rationalize it. And there's a huge link there to the sort of system admin, the people who own and manage the database in the back end, to make sure that actually things are only captured in one place and reused multiple times. So it's that partnership between the clinician and the technical people, and giving them both that voice.
Yeah, and that has multitudes of benefits, and use one, record once, use many times is absolutely fundamental to what we're trying to achieve here, because if you get the diagnosis right, it means you can bring it into all the clinical letters, it can drive assessments, and it can drive workflows, for example. And yeah, that's absolutely right, Nick, totally with you.
And it particularly, and again, it minimizes that, or tries to minimize the clinical risk associated with duplication. And if you feed that into the world of AI, and if you've got different data coming in, being interpreted differently, then it adds a whole different world of complexity.
And also it reduces the amount of data bloat, or information bloat within the record. And a part of that is helping the clinicians to understand that it's not about, for example, the end of shift evaluation. It's about everything else that's happened with that patient during that duty. So if you have a comprehensive record, it's not... Traditionally, for nursing, for example, you would do your shift summary at the end of the shift, and that would explain what you've been doing. With a digital system, you're intervening with the patient every single hour of the day. So you're building up your record longitudinally. So when you come to the end of the day, if you build the record correctly, it should all be there ready for you when you need to sum up your day and go home, which means, and if you don't do that, you end up getting data overload or workload and stress, and you mean you get late off the shift. And if you can, a simple thing like making sure that it's the documentation done correctly, it means you win people over and you get better clinician engagement.
But then you link through to Gen AI, and if you're using that to capture outpatient clinics and record the data in the back end, you need to make sure that it's curated properly.
Actually, sort of, there's a thing I saw the other day, and it's the risks of cumulative data analysis within AI as well. So, if you, for example, if you got a free text note, and you use generative AI in order to do natural language processing on that to extract the appropriate data items, then you further use the AI in order to crunch those data items to give you, say, a diagnosis or an outcome or a plan of care or something like that, then there's that awareness there of if there's a cumulative data processing element, there needs to be also oversight that there is some QC on that to make sure they're not missing anything, or that things aren't being misread into the record due to the way the processing is being done. But that's a fundamental thing with AI anyway, to make sure that we build out the biases and we do the data quality. And that's another piece of education we need to share with our users so that they are prepared for that when it happens.
Thank you. Some great points raised again. Finally then, looking ahead, time to get the crystal ball out, if you like. How do you kind of each envision the evolution of interdisciplinary collaboration and the deployment of digital platforms in the NHS, again, particularly with AI?
So for me, it's particularly the space that I work in. I think we're going to see some really exciting stuff coming from the patient-facing end. And I think that's going to really sort of, I hope, really drive change actually in our existing systems, which have really been designed from a clinical perspective and to meet usually the acute bricks and mortar hospital physical healthcare. I spend most of my time both clinically and in the sort of work that I do digitally looking at where actually currently our system, and I don't mean the digital system, I mean the whole system, really isn't providing holistic care. And once you have all the data available and you have more and more powerful ways to actually look at that, it's going to be even more important to be able to understand that the way that we have built systems to account for someone turning up in clinic in a hospital for 30 minutes or whatever, or a particular procedure, is not the same as what a person needs when they are living their whole life with these digital tools next to them the whole time. And that is where I think is going to be the most exciting changes, and there being a significant amount that are more powerful ways of delivering things digitally, including AI, but not just actually. I think that's going to be where we see, that's where I want to see the really interesting stuff.
I think there's real opportunities around using AI and technology to measure, and I definitely say measure user experience. So that focus on, in the old days, you could do sort of eye tracking usability software, and actually with the computing power and using AI, then you can broaden that out and look at mouse tracking and how people use systems and why they use it. But then you can also use sort of generative AI to work up the design of systems and what it, actually as a clinician, can you build me a system to or a data entry or a template to capture this clinical intervention? And actually you can utilize technology to do that, and then validate it and review it. So actually it'll reduce time and allow clinicians to spend more time refining things and improving things further.
I think Nick and earlier have hit the majority of the points there. But I think if you look at the natural extension of what's going to go on in the future, if people are wearing wearables a lot more now, you've got a lot of people with smartwatches who measure their oxygen saturation and their heart rate and their sleep patterns and this sort of thing. So I think there will come a time when, as Leah says, there will be a time when a patient will be able to contribute towards their record. There will be a suggestion of what the best track and of support may be for that person. There'll be there may be an automatic referral to a particular clinician. But then when the patient gets into hospital, it will help the clinician to to guide the clinician through the process. So, you know, the patients come in with this, we suggest that, not to undermine the clinician decision-making process, but to make sure that there is a range of guidance and options based on the best clinical evidence at the time. So we have to be a little bit wary of it, because as I said before, we need to equip our clinicians to be able to do this, and we're a long way off from that yet. But you know, you could see a situation where a patient could be guided through the entire healthcare process simply through their interaction with the healthcare record, and the clinicians can be incidental in that process, just helping the patient as they journey their way through that healthcare support process. So that's way off in the future, but that'd be an ideal place to be. But you can see it happening with the way that AI is going at the moment.
I don't think that is that way off in the future, actually. I think there's areas where we're kind of already there, actually, on certain things. And actually, a challenge for us in the system is that we are having to play catch up. And I think that and one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting to watch and see really how does that disrupt the way that services currently operate, and how do we anticipate demand, need, as we start to kind of really blur that line between prevention and therapeutic intervention. That's a clinically imposed line. That's a system imposed line. That's not what a person experiences. And I think we're going to see loads and loads more opportunities to be able to do that. But actually, our services are not really yet there to be able to deal with that. But I definitely think it is coming, and it's coming fast.
Yeah, I think it's imperative that we get the basics right before we understand and make sure that the clinicians have access to the appropriate systems, that we're able to collect the right data, that patients can interact and access services appropriately, and we account for people with neurodivergence or limited understanding of technology, so we don't exclude anybody. We make sure that they are not missed, and that there's a safety net there to pick these people up as they go through the system. But I think getting the basics right is fundamental to all this. And I think, as Leah says, we need to make sure that we don't undermine what we're doing because we don't have the fundamentals in place.
And that digital inclusion is for staff and patients. So, of course, we definitely recognise, you know, as anchor organisations, in the area, actually we have a duty and responsibility to develop our staff and empower them to best exploit and utilize technology too.
Definitely.
Brilliant. Well, some really insightful points raised there, and then kind of interesting discussion as a whole on kind of how vital a cohesive team plays when it comes to implementing digital platforms in the NHS. So thank you very much to Leah, Nick and Simon for coming onto the podcast and speaking so well. This will be available to listen back to on all the usual podcast platforms. We plan to have this podcast series for our network's members on a fortnightly basis, so keep your eyes peeled for the next one. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to Digital Health Unplugged. We hope you enjoyed this episode. For more, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favourite podcast platform. And to find out about our latest news and events, head to our website, digitalhealth.net.